I'd like to build on just one point that Ken Mack made about how familiar the NAACP seems to be. It is ubiquitous. Everybody knows something about the NAACP. And sometimes that gets carried over into the assumption that we know the NAACP's history. I think it does not carry over. I think that what Professor Sullivan has done for us is to gaze into that history long and hard, to research it deeply, and to bring us a very complicated narrative about the NAACP. Of course, we get glimpses of it in a Richard Kluger, Simple Justice. We get glimpses of it in the work of Mark Tushnet and so many others. But by my reading, very few scholars or even activists have attempted to write a monograph history of the NAACP. I'll come back to that. The civil rights studies comprise a vast body of scholarship in humanities and social sciences, crisscrossing almost all issues and themes. And within that body of civil rights studies, the NAACP is a part of almost all of those studies in whatever discipline you select. And I would caution us. I would ask that we think about the macro history of the NAACP, not just as an organization, as I think that Professor Sullivan doesn't just see the NAACP as an organization. Her title says the NAACP in the making of the civil rights movement. But what she provides for us here is an anatomy not just of an administrative organization, but also the organic linkage of that organization to a movement. And what we get is an anatomy of the organization as well as of the movement. They reinforce each other. I think that makes this a very special kind of history of the NAACP. Let me mention the four monograph histories that preceded this one. By my reading of the histories of the NAACP, there are five monograph histories, with this one being the culminating and most deeply researched and most scholarly history of the organization. The first one was published in 1943 by a Morgan State College professor named Robert Jack. His history covered the period from the founding in 1909 to 1936. And of course, his history ends with the NAACP moving into the New Deal coalition. The second one appeared in 1962, authored by the writer and activist Langston Hughes. It recounted the association's first half century, culminating in the sit-ins and the freedom rides and the movement, the direct action movement against Jim Crow. Dickinson College professor Charles Kellogg in 1967 published the third history of the NAACP, which was deeply researched, but chronologically very, very focused on the period from 1909 to 1920. In 2005, NAACP fundraiser Gilbert Jonas published a large history of the NAACP following a documentary path, much like Professor Sullivan's, very deeply into the NAACP's papers and records, the Black Press, the crisis. And of course, he devotes a good deal of attention to fundraising in a separate chapter, as well as three chapters to labor and one chapter to anti-communism. Having read Professor Sullivan's book throughout, I appreciate the fact that she deals with all of the issues that Jonas details in great detail, that she interweaves them into a narrative that is eminently teachable, that my undergraduates can digest, and that one can understand. Labor appears very much in her 1930s chapters. I appreciate the fact that she makes the UAW a central player in the ways in which the NAACP develops its litigation and fieldwork campaign, as well as how the story between the migration from the South and activism and the development of the Black vote outside of the South, that those were central parts of how the civil rights movement got made. They were central parts of how the civil rights movement pressed the national administration. Because the founders from the beginning recognized that it was important in order to talk about American citizenship to think about how the United States Constitution, and particularly the 14th and 15th Amendments, would become usable in approaching the federal government, particularly the federal courts, including the United States Supreme Court, which had been so instrumental in legitimating the Jim Crow system. So the UAW is there. It's very much a part of the way in which we think about the NAACP. And of course, questions of anti-communism are interwoven into her narrative. And I appreciate the way in which she does not get involved in all of the polemics on the charges of anti-communism against the association. She helps us to understand that Walter White certainly had a lot of problems with the CP over the Scottsboro cases. She doesn't dwell on that, but she states that as a fact and she moves on. It does seem to me that after World War II, that as the association was trying to maximize its capital, that there were issues in anti-colonialism, in its attempt to hold its alliances together, that there were some evidences of anti-communist activity on the part of people like Roy Wilkins and others in the mobilization that led to the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights. But I like the deft way in which she handles this so that we don't necessarily get bogged down into some of the polemics that I think we respond to in the scholarship. So let me take just a few minutes. I won't go into detail with examples, but I've listed about 12 areas. I'll only perhaps deal with five or six, in which I think Professor Sullivan provides us with fresh thinking and fresh analysis of some of the issues that we thought we knew so much about. First, on the origins of the NAACP, she deftly connects the NAACP not only to the vision of the white founders, but she integrates that vision with the vision of the black founders, of people like Du Bois, who had very much been a part of earlier movements, the National Negro Convention movement, the Niagara movement. And so Du Bois brought a vision of how if African Americans were going to realize the promise of the 14th and 15th Amendments, that they were going to have to build coalitions, that they were going to have to move into the courts, that they were going to have to press the National Congress. And therefore, agitation through publicity and protest, as well as through direct action. The NAACP was very much a part of nonviolent direct action in African-American communities long before the Wichita sit-ins of 1958. The picket lines against the birth of a nation. Picket lines in African-American communities, don't buy where you can't work. The NAACP was there, along with its partners in women's organizations, black churches, and other local organizations. And so on the origins, she gives us very much some fresh thinking. On the complexity of African-American infrastructure that the NAACP organized within, the churches, the women's organizations, the civic groups, the NAACP approached communities, approached fieldwork with an intelligent appraisal of what was going on in those communities. And this happened, mind you, 30 years before Ella Baker came aboard. She brought something special to the organization, but I think that understanding of the infrastructure was there. She enlarged it. She institutionalized it. She developed local leadership. She believed in grassroots organizing. But it seems to me, at least I hope to be corrected if I'm wrong, that that was there on arrival. May Nerney, others preceded her in that respect. On the interrelationship of litigation and fieldwork, I won't say much about that, but it seems to me to marry the NAACP to the civil rights movement, that they are inseparable. This is what I see in Charles Houston. This is what I see in Thurgood Marshall, William Hasty, and many of the other lawyers who were very important in the development of the organization and the movement. A couple of more areas. The Great Migration. I do a lot with the Great Migration in my own African-American history courses, and I think it is incredibly important to think about the ways in which poor and working-class black people moving out of the South, how they became part of an electorate outside of the South, not only a voting electorate, but also a working-class movement. These were the people who were in search of jobs. These were the people who became members of labor unions. But that vote provided leverage for Walter White and others to approach the White House, to put pressure on the Congress, to agitate for anti-lynching legislation, and so forth. And at the same time, through the litigation, it provided leverage for re-enfranchisement in the South, so that more and more African Americans became re-enfranchised by the time of Smith versus Allwright and certainly the post-World War II period. I'm getting my time called here. Let me just say that on women's leadership and organizing, that this book provides ample new evidence and food for thought.